Well, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, depending on where you are in the world and what time it is when you're tuning in. This is Perrin Desports, and I'm your host for the Group Practice Accelerator podcast from Polaris Healthcare Partners. If you're an entrepreneurial dentist or physician, and you're interested in building a successful group practice, you found your primary resource for some of the industry's best business education. My partner, DeWalker Sinha, and I have decades of experience helping people just like you launch, scale, and ultimately exit successful group practices. In short, we create clarity, confidence, and results. Welcome, everybody, to yet another episode of the Group Practice Accelerator podcast. I've brought on way too many guests recently. I think we'll all agree upon that. That's right, I'm taking the microphones back. It's yours truly, flying solo today. I'm going to give you three trends that we're seeing in the marketplace play out. This is a little bit of prognostication for the future, but some interesting things that are unraveling in the, I'd say, early stages of 2024 that you're definitely going to want to pay attention to. So get your pad and pen ready. You know it'll be a note-taking episode, and brew another wonderful cup of that Mila coffee. The Group Practice Accelerator podcast is on the air. Welcome, everyone, once again to the Group Practice Accelerator podcast. I am your host, Perrin Desports. I want to spend a little bit of time today talking about trends, prognostications, reading the tea leaves, whatever you might want to call it. But there's some things afoot, and DeWalker and I have referenced a few of these. Kyle and I did as well in previous episodes, but I'm going to put a bow on a couple of them because this is some kind of neat trends and some things that are no longer just bubbling beneath the surface. They're coming to fruition. And I think this is going to impact the way that 2024 plays out, and most likely into 2025 as well. So here we go. First things first, if you are like me, you either read or have shoved down your ears or throats all sorts of economic prognostications. Most of this is driven by what's the Fed going to do with lending rates, coupled with rates of employment and certainly inflation and maybe even the presidential election around the stock market, right? So I get more of this kind of stuff than I can read, more than I want, more than I can quickly unsubscribe from. And if you are like I am, you're probably aware of it even when you don't intend it. There's a lot going back and forth right now around rates of inflation. Is the Fed going to cut rates at all? Is it going to cut rates twice before the end of the year? What are the labor markets looking like? Is it starting to cool? Blah, 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 blah. Yeah, that's a lot of noise at a macro level. But I think regardless of how that plays out or how quickly that plays out, and regardless of who wins the presidential election this year, there are a couple of trends as it relates to both M&A activity and overall credit and lending right now. And I think it bodes pretty well for most of the people in this audience. So let's unpack the first one as it relates to M&A activity, because that's a topic we've been talking about recently with Kyle Webster, and certainly when DeWalker was on with me for a couple of sessions. Overall, I think we're seeing the capital markets loosening, and rates really haven't come down too precipitously recently, though they're starting to slightly. And if the Fed cuts rates, that will have a positive impact upon the borrowing rates for so many in our audience. It will also have a positive impact on many of the private equity-backed enterprise-level DSOs. Credit markets are starting to loosen slightly. And what I mean by that is that there is progressively becoming more credit available. As it relates to M&A activity, from an enterprise-level DSO standpoint and from a private equity entrant into the marketplace standpoint, we are seeing a significant turn in overall interest and activity levels. We've got a couple of what I would call major transactions in market that are that are worthy of private equity entrance into the space, meaning a private equity group that's not in dentistry right now, or maybe not in that specialty, wanting to get into either that geography, that specialty, or wanting to enter dentistry outright. And they need a certain volume of EBITDA, a certain size and might to warrant all the legal structures and in the initial transaction. So they need a business big enough to support a growth strategy that would unfold over the coming years after that one. And I think as it relates to that, the transactions that we have a lot of interest in them from far and wide, from some industry players and some who would be new into the industry. This is a positive thing, and it's kind of a harbinger maybe of things to come, if you will, because as more and more interest develops around the M&A markets, that means that acquirers, buyers, private equity, venture backed platforms are having more of an interest in the space and are willing to commit the time, the resources, and the focus necessary to execute on those transactions. As we see that at the top of the food chain, that tends to trickle all throughout the industry. So we all know last year M&A was off substantially from some record highs, but off from some, you know, historical norms, I would say. And a lot of that was driven by the increase in interest rates that were impacting the top enterprise level DSOs at the top end of the market, but also the constricting credit boxes that was just less available capital to get deals done, period. So the activity level was down and the valuation multiples were down. Activity levels are starting to pick up, which bodes well for valuation multiples. I don't think they're going to be irrational as they were a couple of years ago coming out of COVID, but certainly these are positive trends for the M&A markets. And we're starting to see some of our longstanding clients return to an interest level, at least, be it committed this year or in the coming years, of possibly taking businesses to market. And I think the timing is working out pretty well with that, because obviously, as you well know, deals of this size take, you know, anywhere from 6 to 9 months on the short end to maybe as much as 12 to 18 months on the long end, depending on complexities and a lot of other factors involved. So as we start looking forward and we kind of come out of last year, there was a bit of a hangover last year, and we start looking at M&A markets, I think there's much more positive outlook involved. And I think that will bear itself out certainly by the end of 2024, and probably more importantly, into 2025. So it's a good thing overall. You start to read the tea leaves as it relates to activity levels. That translates probably into multiples, volume, and everything else that is a bit of a rising tide, if you will, in the overall aspect of M&A activity. The second sort of prognostication or trend or outlook is the other side of that same coin that I just mentioned. And it is the starting the bubbling of availability in the debt capital markets. The reason that I led with M&A is because private equity ventures obviously use debt funds to make their equity investment go further. But a lot of our clients are what I would call still the build and operate type of a business. There, we do have a number that have expressed interest, that are either in market or expressed interest in going to market, but there are also a lot that are in the, you know, 3 to 5 to 10 location space that are looking to grow the businesses they have. And they are really not close to going to market. They're much more of the building a business over the next decade or so, and potentially exit at some point or bring on an equity partner down the road. But that's not anywhere in their intermediate term focus. And these are businesses that got kind of throttled, if you will, with the rise of interest rates. And it kind of ground the doctor-to-doctor transaction market all but to a halt. I'm not talking about a junior associate buying out a senior dentist and, you know, working out a practice level transition. I'm really talking more about somebody who may have 5 to 10 locations, who's looking to buy or build a handful more over the next 5 to 10 years. The rise of rates, you know, stalled a lot of that activity, and justifiably so. But this is something now that we are seeing a dramatic level of activity increase from our core clients who are entrepreneurially driven and are looking to secure a growth capital facility for the next 5 to 10 years. We have arguably more work in this side of the business for us than we have probably since we launched Polaris 3 years ago, and even reaching back into the recesses of my mind in the prior company. There's more interest from probably many of you in the audience about not only debt recapitalization services, but growth facilities. And I think the reason for that is severalfold. One, there are a lot of people who are really interested in the build and operate strategy. That's the first thing. They're not interested in build to exit, imminent transactions. They're looking to build a business for the long haul. The second thing is most of them are at a stage where they probably have a handful of practices funded by a couple of different banks, and they've been listening to our podcasts or consuming our content, or maybe have already hit the debt funding wall and they're running out of retail banks to work with. The third thing is we've talked a lot about growth facilities, credit facilities. They operate as a, as you and I would relate to, a line of credit. So it's a lending commitment from a bank, an enterprise level bank, middle market or lower middle market bank, where they make a lending commitment to you in terms of some amount of volume. And they also tell you in a term sheet how the credit facility renews year over year. So it's not just a one-time draw upon it. It revolves and rolls over, usually on an annual basis. The thing about these credit facilities is the rate you pay on the debt is calculated at the point you draw upon it, not on what the lending rates of today are. So I think rightfully, there are a lot of entrepreneurs who are running out of retail bank capital, who still want to grow their business, and they see the opportunity to either buy or build a number of locations in the next 5 to 10 years. And to their credit, they are trying to get their financial house in order to take advantage of that. And a commitment in terms of a credit facility where they know rates are probably going to be coming down over the next 12 to 24 to 36 months, they're skating to where the puck is going to be, not where it is right now. And if you get these credit facility committed from a lender, then you have the benefit of knowing you have the commitment in your back pocket in a declining rate environment. And that is super critical to being able to access or accelerate, if you will, your expansion strategy in the coming years. And I give a lot of the people credit who've reached out to us and wanted to start to entertain these types of conversations, because they're very forward thinking. When I say forward thinking, I'm not talking about 6 months out. I'm really talking about 12 to 24 to 36 months or longer. The beautiful thing about lower middle market and middle market lending with a credit facility is, as long as you continue to operate your business to the degree of success from a number of ratios, at least, the credit facility will continue to re-up. This really should be your last stop in traditional lending before you bring on an equity partner down the road. So it's kind of a set it and forget it type of a scenario, as long as you continue to execute on your business plan. And I think that's a really cool competitive advantage for you to have if you are one of those people who wants to build a, I don't know, 5 to 10 to 20 location business over the coming decade or more. And there's going to be a lot of opportunity to do that, it goes without saying. But to have the funding commitment in your back pocket that you can deploy every bit as quickly as a private equity group could from an acquisition type of a strategy is a massive competitive advantage. And just as a frame of reference, the groups that we're presently working with, I think on the smaller end of the funding scale, total commitment about, I think we got one at 5 million and one that's about 10 to 11 million in total commitment. Some of that is debt recapitalization. Some of it is a credit facility. But ones that are probably in the 30 to 50 million window at the top end of the food chain. These are 30 to 50 million is obviously an enterprise level group, and their strategy is not just aggregating market share, but it's also having the funding commitment in place to do more mergers into the business and some types of partnership transitions and retirements out of the business. So they're a $30 to $50 million commitment from a bank to an enterprise level group that's still doctor owned and debt funded. That type of a scenario has multiple tangents to it that are substantially different than the clients we work with that are in that, you know, again, 5 to 10 location range, that are in the probably $5 to $10 million range too. So it depends on what type of business you have, what type of business you aspire to build, and what you want to do with the capital in terms of how to deploy it to figure out the right term structure for both debt recapitalization and the credit facility. My point in sort of taking a second to describe all this, though, is that we all tend to get myopic in our focus as it relates to what's happening in the business right here, right now, today. And we tend to operate with blinders on that are arguably from too dramatic of a short-term perspective. If you push pause a little bit, pump the brakes, and you get your head above the fray, and you start thinking about where do I want to end up in the next 3 to 5 to 10 years? What does the business look like? And what are some of the things I can start doing today to prepare for that? Understanding credit markets and debt structure is really mission critical to achieving all of that. And now is a good time to be thinking along those lines. So if this is something that's sort of been rattling around the back of your brain, probably want to reach out and just have an introductory conversation with us about what something like that might look like for you. It's arguably one of the fastest moving segments of our business right now. And that gives me a lot of positive outlook for the industries that we serve in not just the balance of 24, but in the coming years as well. So definitely a second positive trend there. The third positive trend that I wanted to point to is something that I directly referenced in number two, and that is the sort of build and operate mentality. You know, I think I talked about this in a prior episode, but it might have been a couple of months ago. And I can't remember exactly what I said with it, but I think we're in a different segment of the bell curve as it relates to healthcare services overall, but certainly dentistry being the lead in our business. And what I mean by that is that when you study different markets, could be consumer driven, could be business to business, could be services, could be product, anything like that, you tend to see like a bell curve phenomenon as it relates to trends. And you know, the bell curve is typically borne out from these trends. At the beginning of the bell curve, the tail that's off to the left-hand side of the bell curve, I know I'm narrating this, but you know, those are the innovate, what they call the innovators. These are the people who buy the first cell phone before it's a cell phone, because they want to be on the leading bleeding edge of things. And after you get through the innovators, really thin piece of that curve, you get something called the early adopters. The technology has become somewhat validated, but it's not ubiquitous at all. It's not even commonplace for that matter. But the whatever the widget is, a cell phone or otherwise, it works, right? And there are people who are willing to pay a premium that are in the early adopters phase because they think that the price is reasonable enough, and whatever the utilitarian value of the widget is, it serves their purpose and they can integrate it into their lifestyle or whatever it is they're doing. So we go from innovators to what's known as early adopters. Those services, those widgets, whatever it is, tend to gain mass adoption after the innovators and the early adopters, and as we transition into something called the early mainstream. This is the left half of the meat of the bell curve. All right. This is where whatever the product or service is, has gained notoriety. It's been validated. The price point is reasonable enough. It's easy enough to implement whatever this thing is into your lives, or make it work and make a go of it. And the masses start to adopt whatever the technology or product or service is. Right. And then as the bell curve peaks at the very top, and we go down the right-hand side of the bell curve, the second half of it, if you will, that's called the late majority. So, you know, when we start thinking about the innovators, early adopters, and the first half of the mainstream market, when we think about group dental practices, we tend to talk a lot about private equity driven groups. And they are the ones with the most notoriety, the largest size, the name brands, celebrity CEOs, all that kind of stuff. They were the innovators, if you will, who really pushed the pedal hard and really grew businesses and took a lot of arrows for doing it sometimes. Then you had a lot of the entrepreneurs who saw the trend and said, I'm going to build a business that's not dependent upon my clinical skills. I want to own more than one location. I'm going to take a lot of risk. I'm going to personally guarantee a lot of debt. And I'm going to give it a go. And some of those businesses blew up and didn't survive, and others blew up and not only survived, but they created massive windfalls through private equity investment. And then there were a lot of other entrepreneurs that maybe haven't gone to market yet, but have been quietly toiling away in their businesses to build very successful groups that they're probably going to capitalize on exits this year and in the coming years. And I think those innovators and early adopters have now yielded to the early mainstream, the left-hand side of the meat of the bell curve. And this is the build and operate group that I referenced before. Group practice principles have been validated. The viability of group practices are known. There are a number of solo practice senior dentists that are still in the wave of retirements that are going to be upon us over the next couple of years. So there's ample opportunity to acquire businesses. People are living longer. They have, at least the baby boomers, have a lot of disposable income. They value healthy oral cavities and shiny teeth and all that kind of good stuff, and their oral health overall. And there's still about 50% of the population that doesn't see a dentist on an annual basis. There's, you know, employment levels are at an all-time, multiple decade high, and most of those people have health insurance benefits with a dental component to it. There's tons of trends, a lot of tailwinds blowing in the right direction. And I think today's, maybe younger dentists, if you will, have more of an entrepreneurial mindset. And that entrepreneurial mindset is really the build and operate mindset that I mentioned before, not the build and exit that might have been innovator or earlier adopter on the curve. So I think these are people that are wanting to build a multi-location group. I've started to work with a lot more of them. They are in the 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 location, and they may desire to build a 5 location group, and that's all. And there is nothing wrong with that. I think it's a really prudent strategy, actually, because a lot of these people are earlier stage in their career, and to sell the business right now, it's not like you're going to get enough in terms of dollars of the outcome of the transaction to justify the balance of your career never having to work again. So, I mean, I think if you're in the early stage of the career and you owe it to yourself to think both from a defensible strategy, meaning do you have a big enough business that generates enough revenue volume and probably has enough either locations or associates or all of the above to be a business that can withstand some of the competitive pressures and the changing dynamics of the marketplace to be a viable business for decades to come. And it's really hard to achieve that in a traditional solo practice that generates $700,000 to $800,000 in revenue and has, you know, basically one dentist at the helm of it. On the other hand, if you've got a larger footprint solo location, or if you've got, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 locations and a handful of associates working for you, maybe even some minority partners, this can be a business that's built for the long haul. And I think that's a trend I've been talking about for a little while, but it is absolutely coming to fruition right now. And it's really cool to see, because these are businesses built for the long haul. They don't have a very fast growth strategy, meaning nobody's in a hurry to get to 5 locations by the end of next year if they have one right now. These are businesses that may get to 5 locations over the next decade. So it's a very methodical growth strategy, which means there's usually less risk involved with it. And it's something that you're not in a hurry to just chase revenue or chase locations and end up making a lot of fundamental mistakes. So I think this is a trend that's here to stay. And it is a trend that's good for the industry, good for the profession, and frankly, good for the patients too. So it's a it's something that, you know, is sort of counter to maybe what I started out with today, which was the M&A focus as it relates to some of the credit markets and things like that. But I would tell you also that I think there are probably a lot of people in the audience that are in that. Maybe they have one location right now. Maybe they're about to add a second. They might be about to add a minority partner or hire a couple of associates or something like that. But they may not even technically be a group practice. Or if they are, they're only 1 or 2 locations. And these are the people that we have never really worked with in the past, because we were always focused on the innovators and the early adopters that were in a faster growth ramp. That being said, our business changes every bit as much as yours does, and we've gone back and kind of retooled some of our focus, if you will. And you've heard me talk about the Catalyst Project before, which is a 6-week course that I teach over Zoom. It's kind of like group coaching. And these are Catalyst is the fundamentals and the mistakes to avoid if you're going to build a group practice. And it's taught on a Monday evening. I teach a concept on a Monday evening. And then Friday, we get together as a group and tear apart the concept. And it's an open Q&A. It's kind of a free for all. I like to say it's where the magic happens, because I never really know what we're going to get on a Friday. But these 6-week Catalyst courses have been a ton of fun, because it really gives people who are in the 1 to 2 location range the confidence that they're going to learn something that they can immediately apply. It's highly tactical, and it helps them avoid the fundamental mistakes that plague so many of the groups that we see when they come to us for consulting needs. So, you know, Catalyst is our first entrant into that I don't know if I'd even call it emerging group phase, but it's like pre-emerging group. And if you're in that sort of one to two location space and you're thinking about continuing your growth strategy, Catalyst is probably a good tool in the toolbox. It's 6 weeks. I think the next course, we have it on our website right now, but I think the next course kicks off on like Monday, April the 29th. Not sure when this episode's going to drop, but feel free to reach out to me if you got questions or if you want to find it on our website. I'd highly encourage you to do that. Spend a little bit of time with it. Hopefully you'll be in that class with us. We'll run one more, but probably not until maybe August or September, something along those lines. I'm not even sure yet. The second piece beyond Catalyst for those who do want to build a group practice, and again, you're not in any hurry to do it, is an offering we call Ascendant Executive. That is a four-quarter year-long course that each of the quarters has a theme to it. The one that we're in right now is leadership. And again, I teach all these courses. They're Tuesday nights with a Friday afternoon free-for-all session similar to Catalyst, but it is much more the foundational aspects of building a multi-location group and running a more effective business. Some of it is structural, some of it is leadership, some of it is execution, and you can find out more on our website about it there. The Ascendant Executive group that I've got right now in quarter two on leadership is closed, but we will open up the next quarter, which will be after the 4th of July. It'll open up probably sometime in June. But if you're looking for business level education on how to build and operate a better business, be a better executive, Ascendant Executive is exactly what you're looking for there. So I think between Catalyst and Ascendant Executive, we've started to focus more on the emerging group practice space, where we really, frankly, have never had many service offerings before. These are easier access because they're all taught over the web. I teach both of them. They're not one-on-one like our consulting program is, but they're not intended to be. And I don't think that's what that segment of the audience needs. Catalyst is mistakes to avoid, whereas Ascendant Executive is, how do I become a better business owner, business leader, and more confidently build the business that I aspire to when I'm not in any hurry to do it. So if any of that appeals to you where you are in your growth journey, certainly check out our website, or you can feel free to shoot me any questions about it. I'd be happy to hop on a call with you or trade emails and try to explain a little bit more about what goes on in both. Point being in this episode, that frankly probably ran a little bit longer than what I thought it would, is that where we stand right now in the overall economy is a lot of uncertainty. You know, can the trend continue in the direction that it has, or are we, you know, are we staring down some type of a cliff in the coming months or quarters or even year? And I don't think any of us know the answer to that right now. But what I would tell you from an M&A perspective, from a lending perspective and credit market perspective, as well as entrepreneurial mindset, I think we're in a pretty good place. And I think there are a lot of people building successful businesses that are going to have a lot of options at their disposal. And I think that's a significantly, substantially different message than what we probably would have communicated 6 months or 9 months ago. And I think we're in a better place for it. I'm really excited to see how it all unfolds. And we're going to be in the dead middle of all of it. So thank you so much for being a listener and a subscriber. We really appreciate all of you sharing the podcast with your colleagues and the accolades you continue to share on our behalf. We work hard at all of our content and certainly delivering services that are impactful to all of our clients. Thank you for being in the audience. Thank you for being a listener and a subscriber. And I'll see you on the next episode.